You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com.
This is episode 14 of the Short Story Geeks podcast for November 2nd, 2011, with your hosts, The Niche, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg. Sponsored by GnomeCo Publications, the hardest working gnomes on the web, at GnomeCoPublications.com. That's GnomeCo with a G. Hello, and welcome to episode 14 of the Short Story Geeks podcast. I am The Niche, and with me I have...
This is Buck Turner.
And this is Graveyard Greg.
And we were hoping to get this episode out before Halloween, but due to our old foe's schedule conflicts, we're recording it on Halloween. So instead, it's just going to be a regular old episode. So no spooky goofiness this time. Almost no spooky goofiness this time. Instead, we're going to jump right into the headlines. And I'm going to start. The Strand magazine has found yet another lost mystery story. This one is by Cornell Woolrich, who's known for writing Rear Window. It's going to be appearing November 8th. So that's basically in the next coming week. It was first published in Double Detective magazine in 1938, and it's called Never Kick a Dick. So that ought to be fun. You know, Woolrich is pretty well known among the pulp noir aficionados, and like I say, he's most well known for writing Rear Window. So be on the lookout for that. Next, we have Buck.
Well, the next story here is something out of the Minnesota Review Creative Writing blog, and it is a short story challenge, and the challenge is The Happy Story. It starts with the premise of questioning whether it's unhappy people that write, or is it that just people aren't happy in general, but why are short stories about such unhappiness? And kind of swings around to, well, maybe it's the reader's fault, or maybe it's the perception of the reader's fault that a story about happy people being happy is frightfully dull and won't sell and won't get read and won't be enjoyed. So it ends with a challenge to the, you know, the writing community that it serves, is to write a story about happy people becoming happier with points deducted for irony.
I like that last touch.
Well, you kind of have to when you're challenging a bunch of gloomy Gus writers who write misery and pain and sorrow to write a happy story about people getting happier. You got to have to give them that little no tongue-in-cheekness. Otherwise, it's just going to be more irony than U.S. Steel has.
All right, Greg, what have you got here?
All right, apparently Harlan Ellison is making the news again, in which he is suing the creators of In Time, which is a new science fiction film written and directed by Andrew Niccol, who did Gattaca and Simone, and it's starring Justin Timberlake and Amanda Seyfried. I think that's how you pronounce it. So, in Ellison's story, an impish rebel named Harlequin, jokingly modeled after Ellison himself, rebels against a futuristic society where the time that people have left in their lives is methodically monitored and even policed by the government. Residents in Ellison's future have internal clocks that get processed by the Master Timekeeper, a heartless martinet that never hesitates before punishing tardy civilians by robbing them of precious hours, or even years, of their lives. This is the short story, Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man. Now, in time, people have internal clocks, and once they hit like 24 or 25, they live on limited time. And everything costs time. A cup of coffee could cost like 4 minutes. So, and there is the head timekeeper, an immoral authority figure who paces around in a matrix chic leather trench coat. Murphy's timekeeper doesn't care about justice, but rather about keeping time in the right hands. Sounds to me like Harlan Ellison might have, you know, justification for this lawsuit.
Repent, Harlequin is it's a well-known story. Even people who are not sci-fi fans have read this story. You know, it's Harlan Ellison's most widely read story. It's been translated into almost every language in the world. So, yeah, it's like, you know, writing a story about a wizard school and having the main character be, you know, Larry, who lives under the cupboard. It's something where there's enough similarities to a well-known piece of work that it's going to get attention. For what it's worth, I do recommend reading Repent, Harlequin if you get the chance. It's very short, but it packs a big big punch.
Yeah, according to this article, for the sake of comparison, Ellison's short story is a fundamentally Carnival-esque look at a future where being late is a potentially lethal offense. It is funny and bleak in that order. The opposite is true of In Time. Every joke that Nicole's character makes seems to be made through gritted teeth, and the gags are forced. In the film, there are 99 seconds only stores instead of 99 cent stores. So apparently, In Time, it sucks. Harlan Ellison's story, it's good.
Yeah, pretty much. All right, that's it for the headlines, unless anybody knows of one that we missed. So we'll jump on into the discussion section.
Hello, listeners. How are you? Fantastic. Because you're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com. I'm wearing a headset.
Not actually Isaiah Mustafa. Isaiah Mustafa's fees are way out of our budget. Void where prohibited.
For my discussion this week, speaking of happy people getting happier, I'm going to talk about a Jeeves and Wooster story. In this particular case, I'm going to talk about Jeeves in the Springtime. Now, this was actually two separate stories that were stitched together because they're more or less two halves of the same tale. It was originally released in Strand Magazine, speak of which, in 1921 as Jeeves Exerts the Old Cerebellum, and then later on as No Wedding Bells for Bingo, which was sort of the second half of the story. They were stitched together for book publication in 1923 in The Inimitable Jeeves. So this is quite an old story, and it's one of the earliest of the Jeeves and Wooster stories. And the basic premise, let me give you a little sample, and then I'll get into the premise. Morning, Jeeves, I said.
Good morning, sir, said Jeeves.
He put the old cup of tea softly on the table by my bed, and I took a refreshing sip. Just right, as usual. Not too hot, not too sweet, not too weak, not too strong, not too much milk, and not a drop spilled on the saucer. A most amazing cove, Jeeves. So dashed competent in every respect. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I mean to say, just take one small instance. Every other valet I've ever had used to barge into my room in the morning while I was still asleep, causing much misery. But Jeeves seems to know when I'm awake by a sort of telepathy. He always floats in with the cup exactly 2 minutes after I come to life. Makes a deuce a lot of difference in a fellow's day. How's weather, Jeeves?
Exceptionally clement, sir.
Anything in the papers?
Some slight friction threatening in the Balkans, sir. Otherwise, nothing.
I say, Jeeves, a man I met at the club last night told me to put my shirt on privateer for the 2 o'clock race this afternoon. How about it?
I should not advocate it, sir. The stable is not sanguine.
That was enough for me. Jeeves knows. How? I couldn't say, but he knows. There was a time when I would laugh lightly and go ahead and lose my little all against his advice, but not now. Talking of shirts, I said, have those mauve ones I ordered arrived yet?
Yes, sir. I sent them back.
Sent them back?
Yes, sir. They would not have become you.
So that sort of gives you the relationship between Jeeves and Wooster. Bertie Wooster is a rich, young aristocrat. He's unmarried, has no children. He's referred to often as a social drone. Does nothing productive. He just fritters about having a carefree life. And Jeeves is his valet, his sort of do-everything guy, and also acts as sort of a surrogate parent, getting Bertie out of trouble. Often. And sort of solving things for people. That's Jeeves' big thing. Whenever anybody that Bertie knows has a problem, they immediately come over and ask Jeeves for advice, which drives Bertie nuts, actually, because he wants to be the one they're coming to. And the premise of this particular story is that one of Bertie's pals, Bingo Little, has fallen in love with a waitress. Now, of course, Bingo Little is also an aristocrat, and this being the 1920s in Britain, the idea of an aristocrat marrying a waitress was something of a shocker. So Bingo lives on an allowance from his uncle, and he's afraid that if his uncle finds out he wants to marry a waitress, Bingo's uncle will cut him off, so he asks Bertie to ask Jeeves for advice. What Jeeves eventually comes up with is Bingo's uncle is sick, so he suggests to Bingo reading romantic stories in which marriage of a young wealthy aristocrat to a person of the people is celebrated as being, you know, very open-minded and noble, etc., etc., etc. Bingo goes along with this idea and starts reading the romance novels of Rosie M. Banks to his uncle. And there are things like Only a Factory Girl is the most famous one that gets mentioned a lot. And Bingo sweetens up his uncle enough to consider this arrangement. And to sort of seal the deal, Bingo says, I know the author, Rosie M. Banks. I will introduce you. And he comes over to Bertie's house and says, okay, Bertie, you've got to pretend to be Rosie M. Banks. Bertie's like, what are you talking about? So Bertie is roped into posing as the author, Rosie M. Banks. He doesn't go in drag. He just says, you know, Rosie M. Banks is a pen name. And, you know, of course, hilarity ensued. The great thing about the Jeeves and Wooster stories, though, is they are all very light, very effervescent, very silly stories. So, I mean, these stories really do fit the category of happy people getting happier, like the challenge talked about. Most of them are available free online, so they take a little Googling to find, but they are available. And even if they weren't, you can buy omnibus editions for, you know, $10, $15 that have most or all of the stories in them. So that's that one. Next, we have Greg.
All right. In keeping with my usual traditions of reading stories that deal with death, I'm going to read The New Death. It is a collection of stories from The New Death and Others by James Hutchings. The fun thing about this collection is most of it is, you can term it as microfiction, and it was a challenge for me to actually find a story that was longer than maybe a page or two. You know, coincidentally enough, I found The New Death. The premise is the four horsemen of the apocalypse: death, war, famine, pestilence, and probably the fifth and sixth horsemen, I think the fifth one is lawyers. Death gets a phone call from pestilence, and it turns out that there is a new death coming to Earth. The reason why? Aliens have landed. And it says here, it was the nature of things that each thinking species must have its own death. It would be confusing for the deceased if he visited souls who had no idea where the scythe was, and who could not recognize a human skeleton. So, I'm going to read another couple of paragraphs here, because it's just darned entertaining. The alien death arrived a few days later. It appeared as a floating series of equations, which proved the inevitability of increasing entropy in a closed system. My mortals do not anthropomorphize death, it explained. Death would have raised an eyebrow. There may be some residual superstition, it conceded. I thought you'd be a bug or something. A bug? My mortals do not resemble the insects of your planet. Sorry, I hope that wasn't racist. This science stuff is just so overwhelming, you know? Like, we have aliens. Real aliens. Right next to normal stuff like shopping malls and the secret vampire world government. Anyway, do you have... a ray gun? Death indicated his scythe. Your agricultural implement? I understood that humans had invented the combine harvester. It's more of a symbol. You know, to strike fear into the hearts of the dying. My mortals do not fear dying. Oh, wow. You poor thing. Death was genuinely moved. Over the next few months, the death of Earth encouraged the alien death to become more frightening. He showed it the finest Iron Maiden posters for inspiration. Try and make your voice deeper, he suggested, and maybe laugh a bit. That's frightening for humans, although you shouldn't tell jokes. I'm not really sure why one and not the other. Just trust me. But don't go totally copying me, okay? In the 80s, I had this guy who used to follow me around called Skeletor. Anyway, just get your own style. And the story continues on, and then there is a twist. The alien death falls in love with the death of Earth. Needless to say, the alien death has assumed a form to be more pleasing for the death of Earth. I'll let you imagine what that could be. But anyway, the gods are not pleased. And I won't ruin the ending of the story. You should go read it. It's The New Death and Others by James Hutchings.
That definitely sounds like a brain hurter.
You would think it's a brain hurter, but it's well written. And thus, it doesn't hurt your brain too much. Just, you know, try not to think about it too much.
There are plenty of well-written brain hurters.
Yeah, I would say that certainly sounded like it was in the vein. I read about a third of the New Death myself over this past week. And it always does seem to be quite whimsical in its macabreness.
Whimsical, yes, because, you know, I assume brain hurting was something to be bad. I don't think I've ever personally read a well-written brain hurting, because it hurts the brain.
Well, I mean, I consider a lot of Monty Python to be brain hurting, so...
I just consider them to be funny. They don't hurt my brain, they just tickle my funny bone. Nietzsche, you should go see my therapist about that one.
That's okay.
Fine.
Buck, what have you got?
I've got a story here from an anthology called Manhattan Noir. It's called A Nice Place to Visit by Jeffrey Deaver. Before I get into the story itself, I wanted to talk a little bit about the anthology. It's part of a larger series of various place names noirs. So you've got Brooklyn Noir, DC Noir, Seattle Noir, and it really kind of takes its focus, you know, from its writers to really look at a place and how the place influences, you know, the people in there, the events in there. Mm-hmm. And each of the stories in this particular volume of Manhattan Noir are all set around one very specific part of Manhattan. It's got a really good introduction about kind of the egoism of Manhattan Manhattan, how it is basically the city, even among New York with its five major cities, each of which are probably bigger than, 90% of every other city in the world. Manhattan is still the city. If you're in Brooklyn and you're going to Manhattan, you say you're going to the city. Never mind that Brooklyn is already bigger than, any two cities in just about any neighboring state that you can find. And it really kind of, in some ways, that it'll play into the stereotypes, the tropes of noir to a T. And in some of the stories, it's a little bit taking a different view of it. In A Nice Place to Visit, it really is what you think of when you think of a modern noir. It is a modern, it doesn't go back to the 40s gumshoe, but it really is very much multi-levels of con games going on at any given time. Never quite sure who's on what level and how it's going to turn out until the very end. You don't want to say too much just because it is spoiler-tastic when you kind of get it all together. But it really kind of follows, for the most of the story, it follows the story of a relatively small-time con man, Ricky Kelleher, as he goes through some various deals in Hell's Kitchen, New York, which has been kind of gentrified into Clinton, New York, but has a reputation from the bad old days as one of the places where you really don't want to go. Even if you live there, you don't really want to go there or be there. It's a pretty rough neighborhood, lots of different mixed ethnicities kind of scrapping and fighting for power and, running scams here and there. And it really is just about each new turn of the page reveals a new level of this kind of web, this scam that's going on. And it does have a really great ending at the end. It is for such a hard story, it is a very positive ending in a way. In a noir way, certainly ends badly for some people, but it ends good for others. And it really is something that you could almost see somebody like Tarantino putting up on screen. It's just that kind of a twisty, turny roller coaster of, we're rooting for this guy. Oh, wait, no, we're not rooting for this guy. Or, is he going to make this? He's not going to make it. And then the end just kind of comes and hits you from the side of, like a Mack truck. So definitely a good story, and everything in this anthology that I've read has been really top notch. So it is something I recommend checking out. Then they have actually a second volume specifically of Manhattan. That's Manhattan Noir Classics. So a lot of the old classic writers. I think they even had some Lovecraft in there, I believe, about one of the stories he wrote about a New York borough.
That would probably be The Massacre at Red Hook.
Yep.
Which is like Lovecraft's second most racist story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that sounds good. From here, we will go into the bloody pen of the ranting editor. Kaboom.
Listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com has been clinically proven to make you smarter and more attractive. That's shortstorygeeks.com.
Not actually clinically proven. May cause confusion or spontaneous fits of giggling. Void where prohibited.
The bloody pen of the ranting editor!
And this week I actually did find myself relatively inspired by one of the headlines here, the one I read from the Minnesota Review, about the happy story. And kind of got me to thinking, and I just kind of had to pull up my little spreadsheet of submissions that I've gone over for Roar and what I took and what I didn't take, and just kind of thinking, what would make a happy story, and is it something that, we would want to publish, that we want to read? I know a lot of people love kind of that happy ending, and it's a matter of saying, is that happy ending? Well, there's a lot of nowadays, it's like, how real is that happy ending? And it's, in a way, it's such a cynical age nowadays that you don't really trust a happy ending anymore. So it's something that it really does make a quite the challenge to make a happy story, or to make a story that is happy have some kind of conflict to get people really involved in it. Because when you've got a happy character who's kind of bouncing along and who's happy, who's not really troubled by anything, well, how do you make it interesting for a reader? And some people do that with kind of the effervescent language, the description of them kind of bouncing through these scenarios, not unlike the P.G. Wodehouse with Jeeves and Wooster, where they're just kind of like ducks in a rainstorm, where it's just, you know, there's things that are happening around them, but not necessarily to them, and it's about how they kind of navigate those waters. But then a lot of times you can see a really bad happy story, and that it's just not interesting. There's no conflict. Nobody has a goal in the story. Nothing's really happening, and that's the kind of happy story that I think the short story challenge was kind of deriding in, sort of that, you know, it's, you know, the authors, they're miserable people, or people won't want to read a happy story because it's so boring, you know. And I've got to say, I can't imagine that that's 100% true. I'm sure it's not 100% true, even if I can't at the drop of a hat think of a short story that's particularly happy, that's particularly compelling. You got to figure it's been done. And, you know, I'm sure it's been done quite well. The challenge is now, really, if you're going to do something like that, how do you make it work for, you know, such a cynical audience in this modern age where everything has been done? Everybody's kind of jaded and, you know, seen it all, heard it all, read it all, or thought they did. And really, I don't know the answer to that, in how you would make a story that is about happy people getting happier and have that kind of compelling narrative or storyline. I mean, certainly you have to have some obstacles in some fashion, otherwise it's not really a story anymore. There's no plot if there's no thing that you want or way to get happier.
Well, what immediately comes to my mind is actually Bugs Bunny. The earliest Bugs Bunny cartoons, he was just this sort of annoying troublemaker, go around giving people grief for no good reason. And they discovered after the first couple that was just not a compelling character. So what they did is they came up with the idea of Bugs is content in his little world, and then somebody comes along and screws it up. And so he spends the rest of the cartoon getting back at them for that, you know, and or overcoming whatever it is they want. So the classic sort of perfect Bugs Bunny cartoon is one where he's sitting there playing his banjo, happy as a clam, while up the top of the hill there's this opera singer practicing, and Bugs Bunny's music keeps interfering with the opera singer's practicing. So the opera singer comes along and smashes the banjo over Bugs Bunny's head. And Bugs just says, you know, well, of course you realize this means war, and so goes and screws up the guy's concert. And at the end, snatches up a banjo out of the orchestra and plays Good Evening Friends, and he's perfectly happy again, you know. So this is the sort of thing where what you do is, you know, you create a happy character who's, you know, content, and you screw that up, and the conflict of the story is getting back to the happy place. That's one way to do it. That's how the Jeeves and Wooster stories are set up. You know, Bertie is tootling along, you know, singing in a bathtub in the morning, and an aunt comes along, drags him out to the country, and tries to marry him off to some woman he's not interested in being married off to. Again, you go from happy to happiness threatened to happiness secured again. That's your story arc.
Yeah, I do certainly see that. I think it's a little bit different than somebody who's happy getting happier.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, you could go from happiness to happiness threatened to happiness multiplied. That could happen too. I mean,
it's definitely a kind of a genre that you don't necessarily see done well too terribly often, or at least I don't. Maybe it's just the way I am as a reader. I don't seek those kind of things out so much. But that is a more uncommon, really, way to go. And you don't necessarily hear a lot of people talking about writing stories from happiness or getting happiness. It really is a lot of the advice I see, the methods I see thrown around are really all about how to heighten, you know, the anger, tension, frustration, heighten those emotions to get a bigger reaction from your reader. You don't really hear a lot about, well, how do you heighten their contentment or their happiness or their attainment of nirvana, as it were. Which I think would be an interesting approach to take, and it's certainly a challenging approach to keep really compelling to a reader, but I think it would definitely be worthwhile for some people to kind of take up and make a little bit more happy, because I think people could certainly use it.
I've been trying to do some stuff with my Bridget and Greg characters from my fiction lists, and I have found that it is very hard to write a happy story in one respect, which is making the plot happen without the idiot ball, because happy people generally get that way by not being idiots.
Yeah,
if you see what I mean.
And they have a tendency, and I think people have a tendency who, you know, are good writers, they think, well, a reasonable person would pick up the phone and say, what's going on? Mm-hmm. And you can't let that happen in the story necessarily, because then all of a sudden they call up and say, what's going on? And the other character tells them, and they say, oh, okay, have a nice day. And that kind of makes it a challenge. So it is a challenge to keep that story compelling without resorting to blatant outside antagonism. or those kind of idiot balls. You gotta break their cell phone first or whatever.
Yeah, so, I mean, that is a challenge of that kind of a story, is coming up with a way to make it happen that makes sense without screwing up your characters. Any thoughts, Greg? You never write happy stories, do you?
I've been known to write happy stories, but they usually aren't happier at the end. They've just, you know, gone a new branch of happiness. I would think that the story I reviewed, The New Death, the characters start off happy, and at the end, they are actually happier. Without, you know, spoiling too much, I think that is a interesting way. There is still a conflict. I've been trying to think of, you know, they're happy, there's a conflict, and I can't think of many stories where they end up happier. Although, there was this Quentin Tarantino movie, it's called Death Proof, you know, going on the death theme that I seem to be going on, where the characters were happy, and then there was major conflict, and I would think at the very end, they were even happier, too, because if you haven't seen this movie, they totally win. The gals just totally win, and even, you know, even we, you know, the audience was cheering at the end, so it was a very good movie. Although that one, there's this one crash scene, cover your eyes, it's grotesque. But otherwise, you know, maybe if the conflict, you know, whatever is antagonizing them, maybe if the stakes were really high, that could be how they could be even happier. Because, hey, the stakes were high, and they succeeded. Hmm. And back to that Bugs Bunny story, the funniest part was when the opera singer's head started shrinking. I always did love that. On a completely off-tangent side note.
All right. Well, this is something we'll probably come back to at some point, because I think there's a lot of fertile ground for discussion here. But in the meantime, let's go into the end show, shall we?
If anyone could do it, though, Mr. Nietzsche, I think it could be you.
Wow.
Yeah, my challenge would be to, you know, make them even more miserable.
Yes.
That's not even hard.
Well, you know, don't get me started ranting about Grimdark, because I have a lot to say about that, but that's for a future podcast.
You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com. Remember, it's the stories that are short, not the geeks. The geeks are actually pretty tall.
For in-show this week, my plug is something that does not exist yet, but is under construction, which is my new comic, Arclight Adventures, which will be starting in January 2012. The tagline for this is Clockwork Capers on the Other Side of the World. And what it is it's a steampunk comic. It's a slam-bang adventure story comic, and it is set in Calypsotania, which is what's left of Atlantis, somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It was discovered in the 1400s, or early 1500s, by Portuguese sailors following the footsteps of Columbus. They just went a little further south than he did, and boom, in the middle of the Atlantic, they found this continent. It's not unlike Australia, and it's been separated from the rest of the world for so long that it's got its own flora and fauna and ecosystem developed. Except it also has this unusual element called orichalcum, which is what the Atlanteans used to do all of their magic and amazing technology and stuff, which is kind of like plutonium in that it's faintly radioactive, and it releases tremendous amounts of power. So what's happened is that the animal population of this island has developed sort of megafauna. There's, you know, giant bugs out in the desert and things like this. So it's a dangerous place. But of course, the orichalcum provides so much energy that they can make these amazing steam engines using very small amounts of fuel. So the net result is that you have trains that run on the power of a tiny little rock of orichalcum and things like this. And so there's all kinds of crazy wild inventions, lightning guns, and all kinds of crazy stuff like that. And the heroes of the story are the small group of characters referred to as the Arclight Assistants and Monster Dispatch Society, which is basically the five main characters. The brains of the outfit are a Moreau, which is, I'll get back to the Moreaus, but he is a silver fox who is sort of like the Jim Phelps of Mission Impossible. You know, he's the brain who comes up with these crazy plans. Then there's Charlie O'Toole. Charlie is a nickname for Charlotte. She's sort of a gun bunny cowgirl type. There's Big Bad John Dunn, who's the muscle of the group. There is Mrs. Drake, who's sort of a spy, infiltrator, shady character. And there is Verity, who is a gadgeteer and sort of the conscience of the group. And they're a fun bunch, and the main story starts with the induction of Verity into the group, because her father is involved in the creation of these. They're sort of robots. They're referred to as clockworks, and there are clockworks being used to sabotage various industrial things, and so the Arclight Society looks into this, and that gets Verity involved, and so on. I will mention about the Moreaus. The Moreaus are there. I will partially admit to appeal to my existing fans. You know, I'm mostly known for my furry work. And the Moreaus are furry. They are, in fact, an extension of the Island of Dr. Moreau story. In the setting of ArcLight Adventures, the story of the Island of Dr. Moreau actually happened, and if you've ever read that story, that is the framework of that story is it's a manuscript that was found among somebody's papers describing these horrible things that they went through when they ended up on Moreau Island. You know, the end of the story, the person writing the thing says, I don't know if I'm ever going to publish this or not. It's such a horrible thing. So the premise here is that it did get published after the person's death, and some people read about this and said, you know what, we've got to go find this island. We've got to figure out what's going on here. And so they've gone to Moreau Island, and they've basically started up production again. So they're taking animals, and they're using surgical techniques to... Well, the modern term is uplift, I suppose, to make them like people. You know, they walk, they talk, they wear clothes, etc. They go through this very rigorous civilizing process, and they're not allowed to leave Moreau Island until they've been declared humans. They're given a brand on one of their palms, the brand of Hermes, indicates that they are to be considered human beings, even though they're, in Fagin's case, he's a fox. There's, you know, all kinds of them. There's chimp Moreaus, there's dog Moreaus, etc. But there's not that many of them. Not very many of them get all the way through the civilizing process. So Fagin, the brains of the ArcLight troop, is a big Moreau success story, and he's proud of that. But it's something that's going to cause him problems as the story goes on. But it's not all about Fagin. He's not like the one character. It's very much an ensemble piece. You know, every character is going to be important at some point or other. I've gotten 5 or 6 pages drawn so far, and I'm hoping to have more done. We're launching in January, so my intention is to have most of an issue drawn before we ever actually show any on the web, and we'll be putting them up 1 page a week and collecting them into print volumes when they're done. So that's ArcLight Adventures at arclightadventures.com. You can go and take a look now. There's not a whole lot on the website, but there is a piece of fan art from Vince Suzukawa, because he's been helping me with a lot of the character designs. It's something that I hope everybody will enjoy, and I'm really looking forward to it. So that's me. Who's next?
My goodness, Nietzsche, that's probably your longest promotion that we've had on this show, and I would like to add, the website looks fan-freaking-tastic. Just thought I'd mention that.
Thank you.
I guess I'm next. I'm going to talk about, I'm going to go in reverse order. For those of you who like my little short stories, I am now on the Kindle store. I've included a link on the end show. I've got only 3 of the short stories. One of them is Love of the Colossi, which is a naughty little story. It was my first publication in the anthology Fang. I then have Wish Fulfillment, which is an old short story, which I updated to have like a little furry twist in it, so I like that one too. And then finally I have The Last Laugh, which is a Halloween-themed story dealing with giant bunnies on a rampage, or a giant bunny. Giant bunnies and zombies. Gotta love it. And I would like to mention, in Dungeons and Denizens, we are now into chapter 15 of our fine tale, and you Lich Vell fans, Lich Vell is back. And he's not happy with what he's discovered. For one thing, there's a demon lord sitting in his throne, chair, office, whatever. That demon lord being Yebor, who I don't know who I based it off on. Do you have any idea, Mr. Nietzsche?
Looks a little bit like TK Dai.
It does, but no, it doesn't look like TK Dai. But anyway, yes, chapter 15 has started. It started last week. Page 2 should come out if my artist's computer decides to work again. Otherwise, you know, we may have to wait another week. Computer issues, gotta love them. And that's it for me.
All right. And Mr. Buck?
On the other end, I've got, I know, another plug for something that doesn't exist yet, but it's on the shorter end. That is Roar 4, which I am diligently trying my best to find some hours to work on in between all of the other things that need to happen in the next couple of months. But I do have all of the stories selected. I'm starting to work with the authors and try to get some back and forth going there to get everything ready for publication next year.
Okay.
One more thing, Nietzsche. I forgot to ask you this.
Yes?
About ArcLight Adventures. Is this going to be before Further Confusion or after Further Confusion?
Do you remember the dates on Further Confusion?
Further Confusion is like in the middle of the month.
Yeah. I believe the first pages will be going up just before Further Confusion. I think January 9th is the date I have in mind for launch, but I'm not positive of that.
It is definitely before Further Confusion.
Yeah.
For, you know, those fans, you know, like myself, who have been waiting for ArcLight Adventures. I'm not going to complain too much, though, because I can't wait.
Okay. So, let's see. What else do we have in the intro? We have our always our regular call for audience participation, suggestions, news items, general plugs. If you would like to be a guest, or if you have something you'd like to have us plug or review, as we did in the case of The New Death, which was sent to us by a listener, we're very up for that. You can put comments on the website, or you can send us email. iamtheniche@gmail.com. How about you guys?
Turner at baddogbooks.com.
And, of course, I am graveyardgreg@gmail.com.
Okay. If you are looking to sponsor somebody, we're always up for that. And if you'd like to subscribe to us, there is an RSS feed floating in the coffee cup on our website. I'm not sure why it's floating in a coffee cup. It just sort of happened that way.
It's just awesome that way.
Yeah, I guess so. Or you can subscribe to the podcast directly on iTunes. And you can follow us on Twitter as @shortstorygeeks. So, come back in 2 weeks. Our next show will be November 16th, assuming all goes well and the creek don't rise. Do we have a sign-off? I'm guessing that's a no.
Nope, no sign-off.
All right, well, in that case, we'll just say goodnight, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
This has been episode 14 of the Short Story Geeks podcast, with your hosts The Niche, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg, with additional material by Laurie Roby. Intro and outro music provided by the Rat City Brass at ratcitybrass.com. Incidental music provided by freemusicarchive.org and the PodSave Music Network at musicalley.com. All music used with permission under the Creative Commons license or by its creator. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, I was going to review a few of them, but I noticed he tends to have a trend about, you know, he likes death a lot.
Well, you know, that is
kind of the name of the collection.
But yeah, but he likes death.